Hi, listeners, and welcome to this encore presentation of episode 84, Mary, Maude, and Marlo, and the woman who gave them life, which, if you guys remember, is Susan Silver. And it was one of my favorite conversations that I think almost that we've ever had.
Really?
Well, yeah, because it touched, you know me, I like to check a lot of boxes, kind of kill a lot of birds with one stone. And we have such a great conversation about so many things. We talk about strong women and the women influences we had in TV, the TV characters that influenced us. We talk to Susan Silver, kind of the first female writer on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And to know that she impacted one of our favorite sitcoms from our growing up, and to talk to that woman in person was pretty meaningful to me. And then also to highlight just some of the women characters again that influenced us and let us know that, you know what, just because we're a woman, just because we have a vagina doesn't mean sorry.
Well, gosh. Did I get a producer on a TV news show?
Yes. But her contribution, which I think you're probably repeating ourselves, we haven't listened to this one in a while, but her contributions then just kept trickling down as the 70s went on.
That's right.
I mean, One Day at a Time, Alice, you know, we have these powerful single women.
Yes.
Think about it. And I think a lot of that has to do with Susan Silver's contributions to the way she wrote Mary and Rhoda in those episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the way that those episodes were accepted and how people really enjoyed them. It was so great to know that Susan Silver was able to deliver and write these really ahead of their time episodes. And I think probably, you know, we maybe weren't quite sure how these episodes were going to hit with the general public. Mm-hmm. And hit they did. They were hits. Yeah. And I think that kind of laid the groundwork to some of the characters we see throughout the 70s, female characters, because they knew there was an audience for strong women that didn't have to be attached to a guy. Hello, Jamie Summers. Hello, Linda Carter. Hello, Alice.
And yeah, Alice in particular, Alice and Anne Romano from One Day at a Time, those were two women that were really reflecting what was happening in the culture, which was that women were having to raise their families on their own. Divorce was really on the table in the 70s. For the first time, women could file for a no-contest divorce. No contest? Is that what it's called?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, which blows me away.
Like, I know.
That was,
before you
that
had
like
to
our
prove
moms.
It. Yeah, that was our moms. And so it was really difficult for those women, and they had to provide for their children and take care of their children. And so Alice is one of these people that I want to talk about, because we do mention Linda Lavin and her role on the show Alice a little bit in this episode. And we have recently seen a resurgence of Linda Lavin in two shows. The first one being, is it called No Good Deed?
Yes, I think so. The Lisa Kudrow and Ray Romano.
And Ray Romano.
So good.
Mm-hmm. She has just a tiny role in that. And my God, she's so good. Yeah. And then there's a new show, you guys. If you're not watching it, I'm going to be the one ringing the bell for this show. It's called Mid-Century Modern. And this show is the Golden Girls. It is exactly the Golden Girls. Like, it's not even a coincidence. It has to be on purpose, because the premise is three men who are living together on the lanai, except instead of in Florida, they're living on the lanai in Palm Springs. And you have even all of the characters, including the Bea Arthur character's mother, who lives with them, and that is played by Linda Lavin. And you guys, she is the star of that show. She is so good, and she's dead. It kills me. And you guys, it's so dumb. I mean, it's dumb in the same way that Golden Girls is dumb. It is, but it's really a throwback to a different style of TV making.
Yes, yes.
We don't have today. And so for a lot of people, that's going to be cringy. And for a lot of people, it's going to be very comforting. You know, they have a laugh track. I'm sure kids are going to be like, why is there pretend laughter on the show?
Well, it's not made for kids. It's made for our age.
Right.
It's made for our generation. But, yeah, Linda Lavin just died on December 29th of 2024. And I think they were in production of this show.
Yes, they were. I remember reading
so
that.
So what?
It hurt me so badly.
How many episodes? Like, I wonder what then, are they going to address that in the show?
I'm very curious, because they released the whole season at once. So there are 10 episodes. And who knows what's going to happen after that? Will they have to end because there's no mother character, or will they carry on and have that be part of the storyline and have somebody else, you know, does the sister move in instead or something like that?
Well, let's not recast it, people. Okay. Let's just say that now.
Well, how do you recast an 87-year-old?
Right. And you can't replace Linda Lavin because her lines on this show and her delivery of them are so perfect. She is, I'm gonna say it, she's better than Sophia on Golden Girls. And I love Sophia, and I know people have feelings about Golden Girls, but I prefer this mother character. I'm so bereft when I'm watching it knowing that she's going, because she steals the show.
And my God, what a resume that woman had.
I know.
And that in this final hour, the sunset of her life, she was working. She was doing what she loved. While we can definitely say, oh, but how tragic, she was in this new show. You know, look how long Betty White kept acting.
Yeah,
into, you know, by the time she was close to 100. She was in her 90s, I think, when she was doing Hot in Cleveland. And so funny. And so while I wish more than anything Linda Lavin would have continued to have that into her 90s, because she clearly is still has it, right, Kristen? You're saying she still has the timing. She still has the
sharp. Yes.
It kills me that she didn't, but at the same time, I just have to be really happy for her that she went out on a high, right? And she went out doing what she loved.
It allowed this resurgence that she's had, and then when she dies, I was going to say tragically, but it's not tragic. She's 87, but when she dies at this moment, when she's, you know, rising like this, it allows us as the viewing audience to take notice of her again and go, my God, she was good. Let's just honor this life that lived. And if she hadn't been in these shows, it would have been a headline. It would have just been a headline when you'd be like, oh yeah, remember when she was on Alice?
Mm-hmm. And think about, again, we talk about how she was inspiring to us in the 70s as this character, Alice, and then how she's inspiring to us now as women in our 50s, almost 60, that you can have a career. You can be 87 and still, as you just said, Kristen, have the delivery, have the chutzpah, all the things you need. It wasn't like, oh, let's give this old lady a part with a few lines. Like, I often think, how hard is it for some of the actors that are in their 80s, early 90s, like, do they have to stop the camera a lot because they forget their lines? Or for Linda Lavin, she had to be spot on.
She was. She is driving the timing, and she's got it. And the writing is really, really great. It's true, Michelle, that some people might pull it up and it will feel so stilted and overacted. But this is an old style of show. And so if we were looking at this in the 80s or the 90s, we wouldn't think anything about that. It just doesn't match what we see being made today. So a lot of people are not going to watch it for that reason. But if you are craving something old school, I've been craving an old school sitcom because they really don't make a lot of sitcoms anymore. This is as old school as you can get. And I'm so excited for my parents.
Because it's hard for my parents. Yeah.
I mean, think about it. What do your 80 and 90-year-old parents watch on TV? Okay, hi, I'm back. This is an update on how Mid-Century Modern went over with my parents. Gordy might not be a fan. It is a little too explicit for Gordy. I underestimated how explicit the show was. And he was like, yeah, I don't know. And then even Carolyn was like, Kristen, it's really explicit. Do you really think your parents are going to like this? But I did, because of the format of the show. It's just like the Golden Girls. But he will say, he was like, but he did say that he really liked, quote unquote, the lady from the diner show. So that part still holds up.
Okay,
so now make of that what you will. Make your own decisions about what you watch. And now please enjoy this encore presentation.
Segue alert, back to this episode that we're encoring. I think we can put Susan Silver in this category of older women who were strong and are still working. Because even though, most of her credits are things from the 70s and 80s, you know, besides Mary Tyler Moore, Love American Style, Square Pegs, Newhart, Maude, you know, the book that we're going to talk about in this episode coming up, she wrote recently, Hot Pants in Hollywood, and it is a gas, you guys. She's still out there. She's still just being her sassy self. Susan, if you're listening to this new encore or this new conversation, we love you. We think you're awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Susan, we love you and we loved this conversation we had with you. So please enjoy episode 84, Mary, Maude, and Marlo and the Woman Who Gave Them Life.
Even in the readings, it was so interesting. You'd go to the readings, Mary would read it exactly right, exactly the way she was going to do it in the show. Valerie would try different things. She wasn't sure. And Phyllis wasn't even in the room. She'd come late. She wouldn't stay in her place. She didn't know. She hadn't read it. She said, and the camera guys would go nuts because they never knew what she was going to. She was a genius, though.
Hello, world. There's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who got their school supplies at the Ben Franklin for a grand total of one crisp $5 bill.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we'll be celebrating how women's roles on TV changed after a certain someone moved to Minneapolis and threw her hat in the air. And we'll get all the dirt from a very special guest, the writer who brought so many of those stories to life, Susan Silver.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
Hello, world, there's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy.
Prior to the late 60s, TV was dominated by men, and the women on your screen were mostly wives and mothers. And all women, whether or not they were mothers or wives, maybe they were teachers or secretaries, were written by men, who I think we can all agree are not historically gifted at knowing what women are thinking or feeling, until a wave of women writers started inching their way into the writers' rooms of Hollywood, changing the landscape of roles for women forever. Because famously, the Mary Tyler Moore Show was the first to go out and recruit women to write for their female characters.
It's true. Until the late 1960s, women weren't typically ever the main character, were they?
That's
they
true.
Were playing second fiddle. They were the wives. They were the mothers. There were certainly women characters on TV shows, but rarely were they the main character.
They were setting up the joke, oftentimes. Yeah. I mean, even if you look at Mary Tyler Moore herself, who is Laura Petrie, right? Laura Petrie, as hilarious as she was, played a vastly different role in society than Mary Tyler Moore did just 5 years later.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. That's a great example.
She, you know, she was just another stay-at-home mom when she was Laura Petrie. But did you guys know that Mary Tyler Moore refused to give viewers another inaccurate portrayal of being a housewife? And the way she did that is she wore capri pants a lot. And she said,
pants.
Mary Tyler Moore actually said, I had Laura wear pants because I said, women don't wear full skirted dresses to vacuum in. She told TV Guide this in 2004. But Carl Reiner, who was the show's creator, he said he wouldn't let Mary Tyler Moore wear pants in more than one scene per episode. But wow. Mary Tyler wow. Moore said, yeah, I went along with that for about three episodes. And then finally, I was just wearing the pants.
Okay, and think about it, you guys. She was only like 22. So that's pretty
so
ballsy
cute.
To go to Carl Reiner, who is like a comedy god. He's the big boss. Mm-hmm. She's
right.
a kid at 22 years old to make that kind of a stand. That's pretty big.
Well, and that was the type of stand in the late 60s. Let's think about it. Because when I just said that women were typically just the wives or the mothers, I mean, this is also all just a sign of the times, right? This is all
right.
like what's happening. However, you know, women, Mary Tyler Moore is saying, no, women aren't wearing their giant skirts to vacuum mm-hmm. and to run around the house. That's how they're being portrayed on television.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Think about June Cleaver, who's completely made up. Donna Reed, completely made
oh
up.
My gosh.
And they even show them like pushing a vacuum, completely made up.
Right.
Even with jewelry.
The pearls.
Right,
with the poppet
beads.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And their little kitten heels. They're walking
yes.
around the house with their
oh my
little
God,
heels.
Heels.
You guys, you know what's funny is how I said that was a sign of the time. So progress, right? As obviously we can say women in TV as we've gotten older, you know, then we get into, you know, the different types of clothing. Right now, all three of us sitting here, I don't know about you guys, but I'm in my pajama pants, which I will stay in for
oh,
the
yeah.
rest of the day when I'm cooking mm-hmm. dinner. All of us have our hair up on top of our heads. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, life,
yeah.
right?
Oh,
that's right.
Exactly.
You're
exactly.
lucky I'm wearing a bra today.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, you do usually. Thank you. You know who I thought of first?
I noticed you looked a little perkier.
Yeah, now you can see him in the frame. they're below the frame. Yeah. They're just hoisted a little bit. So the first person that came to mind when we were talking about the before and after, the women on TV before, the women on the TV after. In the before, I thought of Lucy. Of course, we all love Lucy. Everybody loves Lucy. And Lucy, as again, as groundbreaking as she was at home, and all she wanted to do was be in the show. She just wanted to be in Ricky's show. It's like women weren't allowed to have a purpose outside of being wives and mothers. Mm-hmm. And so she had a purpose once little Ricky was born. But prior to that, her purpose was to stay home and be Ricky's wife. Despite her begging, she wanted a purpose so bad. Here it is on full display for all of us. I want to be in the show. No, Lucy, you have to stay home. And the great irony, of course, is that Lucy was in charge of that show.
Mm-hmm.
She ran that show.
That's exactly right. Wow. And I guess, you know, the end of the day back then, it was like, well, is the public ready to see it something differently? So even though Lucille Ball might have wanted to do it differently, it was hard to justify that if they were going to have an audience for the show.
Would anyone watch it?
Right. Would anyone watch it is exactly right.
The key word that you guys have used, Kristen, you've used, I think we've all used, but is portrayed, right? I think
that's right.
The key word we're talking about here in women in TV is how they're portrayed. And that's going to be important in our conversation going forward, I think.
Even Carol Brady, like, thank God she had that solo at church on Christmas Eve, because outside of that, who was Carol Brady? What did she do?
Right. Well, we had to wait till the sequels, the movies, because then she was a realtor.
That's right.
But she evolved. Only after the kids were all grown and flown and all of that, could she finally have a career, which that was, again, as a realtor.
Otherwise, her purpose was making cookies.
No, but not really. Alice made them most of the time. Carol always just like was in the kitchen too, like stirring a pot with Alice. But let's ponder this question. What did Carol Brady do all day?
She didn't clean
the
house.
She didn't have to do, I think she went to the grocery store once, the one time where the guy was like, oh, I want to put you guys on commercial. But other than that, you're always seeing Alice coming in with the groceries. And I mean, Alice is like,
oh,
a couple times I think she sewed some costumes. Didn't she?
Okay.
I think there's a couple.
She was knitting once. She was knitting when Oliver came in. And we had cousin Oliver, and I just remember the scene where he came in. And anyway, she was knitting.
So she had a hobby.
Yeah,
but that's still not a purpose. Yeah,
I think this is a fun question to throw out to our listeners. You guys send us DMs with your top three things Alice or Carol Brady was doing during the day. I bet we'll get some
because
really
Mike gets to be an architect.
Right.
So he gets, and he's still taking care of his children and a present father and everything. So it's all about, you know, what is your purpose in addition to being a wife and a mother? It's not that we're saying that these women shouldn't be wives and mothers and they should just be career women. It's that men were able to be well-rounded and that they had a purpose outside of their wives and children, but the women didn't have a purpose outside of the children. And the husband.
Oh, right. We're certainly not saying Carol Brady didn't have a purpose and she wasn't a loving mother. We're just saying the way she was, again, I'm going to use the word portrayed, was that she was always just walking, oh, hi, honey. Like, you know, when Mike comes in, honey, I'm home. And she comes walking briskly out of the kitchen in her pantsuit. Hi, honey. And she gives him a kiss. And like, what was she doing back there? Like,
what was she doing?
I mean, sometimes she's helping Alice, but Alice is the one doing all the housework and that kind of stuff. So, just it's how she was portrayed. We're not saying Carol Brady. Everybody out there, settle down. We're not saying Carol Brady didn't have a purpose and she wasn't a
great
mother.
Alice is a good example too, because you were allowed to be a teacher on TV. You were allowed to be a nurse or a secretary, and you were also allowed to be a housekeeper.
That's right.
You could be a housekeeper.
That's right.
And those are all maternal roles. So even if you think about Aunt B wasn't married, but she is the maternal figure in the show. She was the maiden aunt who took care of the orphans.
Mm-hmm. That's so right. And, you know, it wasn't even just live TV. I was thinking even about the cartoons we were exposed to early when we would watch the Flintstones. I mean, Wilma and Betty, they were just staying
at
home.
Do?
I know. And Jane Jetson. And and Jane, she even had like people to do the stuff for her. She didn't have to necessarily be. Right. Mm-hmm. And Judy, the daughter, she kind of just fed right into that same kind of prototype. So we were kind of before Mary Richards, this was the message that we were getting as TV viewers and as young girls.
And as our special guest, who you'll be hearing our conversation in just a moment, she pointed out, she corrected us. She said, Mary wasn't the first working girl on TV. That was actually Marlo Thomas in That Girl. And actually, Marlo Thomas was offered several scripts to read, but they all focused on women who were either the traditional girlfriend or a wife or a secretary to someone else. And she wanted a show in which the main character was a young, modern, focused woman focused on her own dreams and aspirations. And over time, so finally she got That Girl, and over time she became the producer of the show. And so she made a lot of those decisions about what would happen with Anne Marie.
Well, and one really big decision she made was, Susan, who you'll hear in just a moment, saying, you know, they pitched an idea to That Girl where she would get married and there was going to be a big engagement party to Dawn. And Marlo Thomas said, no, we're not going to have her get married. She's going to stay single, independent.
Right. And I think we talked about in our, it might have been the Free to Be You and Me episode where we talked a lot about Marlo, but that last episode instead was she takes Dawn to a women's lib meeting with her.
Oh, that's right.
So it was like
instead of getting engaged and married,
that was like, come see my world. Let's see what's going on over here. So,
okay. Do you want to know another really great That Girl fact?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This is so great. So in 1968, after feminist protests were burning bras, Marlo Thomas began to go braless on the show. And she said, I'm going to get this on a shirt, you guys, because I'm seeing people around us going braless now. And I'm like, let's do this.
Well, you she are. Said,
yeah.
Except for today.
And some people would say I should not. But I'm going to. This is what she said. And I'm getting this on a t-shirt. God created women to bounce. So be it. I love that.
Is epic. Yeah.
Because Mike will often be like, you cannot do that, Chris. And I'm like, this is the way they were made.
That's right.
They bounce. You know,
that's right. Some of ours don't really bounce. Speak for yourself.
Some of them drag.
We drag them behind us.
Only like one drags. Only no one legs. Of them.
A little water balloon. We're on a leash.
Oh, my gosh.
Even after That Girl and Mary Tyler Moore, we start to see women being portrayed, number one, in a more realistic fashion, where they're able to have purposes outside of their children. And sometimes that's aspirational, right? They're showing us a roadmap. We were the young girls who were watching this show, and now we know that we can envision our futures as something in addition to being wives and mothers. Sometimes it's simply realistic. If you think about Florida Evans or Bonnie Franklin, what was Bonnie Franklin's name on the show?
Anne Romano.
Okay, so Florida Evans and Anne Romano, those were women who were working because they needed to put food on the table. And that's a more accurate portrayal of women's lives than is June Cleaver in her full dress and kitten heels vacuuming without having anyone go after that.
Oh, for sure.
Maybe the market.
You can add Linda Lavin, Alice, to that, too.
Alice.
I mean, these are working class women who are going through all the struggles. I mean, let's not forget it. And Alice, for goodness sake, Tommy had to sleep on a pull-out sofa.
That's right.
Little Philip McKeon had to sleep on a pull-out sofa. So they're just showing that they were portrayed as just a very realistic view of, in the mid-70s, these working class women and the struggles they were facing, but
this
still being wonderful mothers and still being caring and supportive mothers. Yeah.
But also showing us that you don't have to be a wife and a mother to be successful. I mean, Mary Richards, again, a prime example of that. And I'd like to throw out, do you all remember Pepper Anderson?
Oh, no. Policewoman?
That would be Policewoman, which was one of my favorite shows. So Angie Dickinson was actually that was the first police drama that featured a female lead, and it empowered a generation of women. It was the biggest increase in females applying to the police force than any other time in history. I remember her and that role. I think I played Policewoman.
Oh, we did,
and,
for sure.
Yeah. And even though Earl Holliman, I was doing a little research, he was her superior. In my mind, thinking back to the show, he was like her assistant. Like, she was the main one. She drove the ship.
Yes.
And I just loved that show.
Well, and let's spin that out into Charlie's Angels, which is often, sort of demeaned as being jiggle TV. But those women went to the police academy. They were catching bad guys.
Right, exactly.
Well, Jim Cleaver was not catching any bad guys.
They were empowered, right? They were like, yes, I feel like the women in post-Mary Richards in the 70s, they were strong, they were resourceful, they were self-sufficient, self-confident, they were educated, they were empowered. And I think we could, I will even argue that, Ma Ingalls, even though we might, some people might go, well, that's such a traditional role. Okay, of course, the roles were traditional, but Ma Ingalls was fierce. I mean, mm-hmm. she had a strength of physical and just more notable strength of character, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would argue that Ma Ingalls shared a lot of those same qualities.
I mean, that's a character written
in the 70s, too.
That's yes. Right.
The woman she ran into a burning barn. To her leg.
Yes. She saved all those animals in the burning barn. I mean, that was a moment for Ma Ingalls.
But just written differently, right? So we're now in the 70s, yeah. and so they're writing Little House on the Prairie. And of course, they still have to have these traditional roles because we're in the 1800s. But they're writing, Carolyn, to be all of those qualities that we're seeing yeah. in the Alices right. or in the, Anne Romanos, in the Charlie's
She's
Angels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of my favorite women was, as you've heard me talk about many times before, was Lindsay Wagner as Jamie Summers in The Bionic Woman, which was really the first female-led kind of science fiction-y drama. Mm-hmm. Show that really trailblazed for a lot of shows up until now that feature women as leads in this genre, which had never happened before. And I adored Jamie Summers. I mean, and you talk about independent and obviously strong, but Steve Austin loved her. But because of her tragic accident that indeed had her become bionic, she had this kind of amnesia and she didn't remember how much she evidently loved him before. And he was always still pursuing her, but she didn't ever feel that for him, and that she never had really a romantic interest in the show. I mean, she was able to fight Sasquatch and the Fembots, and and we believed it, and we were right there with her, and she wasn't having boink boink, our sex with Steve that I always wanted her to have, but she didn't
that's
have
right.
to.
Like that's, she didn't have to because she has enough story on her own.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
What episode was that where you said that and we were talking about what would the sound effects have been, though, if they would have had sex?
And you know what? I'm not the only one who started to kind of put these together. Do you know that there is a book that a University of South Carolina English professor wrote, and it's titled The Bionic Woman and Feminist Ethics?
I want to
How
take
about
that class.
Them
fantastic.
Apples?
Okay,
isn't
what?
That great?
Taking
that
class. I want to go to college now.
Wait, I had like I had like Com 100, or I had like Religions right. of the World.
Yep.
Art history. Yep. Another right. character, though. Let me mention quickly that sometimes I think goes unnoticed is Elaine from Taxi, Mary Lou Henner. Don't forget, she was keeping up with and in the boys club in a very male-centered occupation at the time. And man, she was right there. She was right with them. I mean, barb for barb, joke for joke. She was just as tough as all of them. And was
she
something
had to put
unusual
up with
to
all,
see too.
It was she had, they were realistic about the harassment that she had to put up with.
Well, that's
both
true
in
too.
The workplace and from customers too.
That is true.
Yeah.
No,
so they didn't shy
point.
Away from that.
I think but they let her. But they showed us how she could take
that's
it.
That's right.
How she could handle
that's
herself.
Right. Yeah. How she didn't succumb. How she wasn't afraid. Mm-hmm. How she just told people to shove it.
Yeah,
and
that's
which
right.
also tells us you don't have to put up with that. You tell them to
right.
shove it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I forgot about Elaine. That's a really good one. I was thinking about this transition time between, the late 60s and when Marlo Thomas and Mary Tyler Moore are giving us this shift. And so it wasn't an overnight transition. And Carol Brady was still sort of a little bit Donna Reed, but she does have her solo at the church. So you see that she is a whole woman outside of her children. And then I thought about Shirley Partridge because she may have worked at the bank, but that wasn't really a strong part of the story. But, and I don't know, maybe were they living off of the life insurance from the dad who we assume died that they never talk about?
They had a real nice house.
It's a lovely house. And I think there is something about her working at a bank. But she's still taking care of her children. This is still a family show. She's not a wife, but we don't think she's divorced. God forbid she wouldn't be divorced, but she still has children to take care of. But she goes back to school. She drives a bus. She sings back up in her children's band. Like mm-hmm. she becomes a more whole person than somebody that's just serving her children breakfast.
Right. And let's not forget, Susan's going to tell us that she wrote an episode for Shirley where she's going to wear some hot pants too. So
that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even Laverne and Shirley, you guys think about mm-hmm. Laverne and Shirley. Yes, they wanted husbands and that was like the running gag, but it was focused on two single women who worked at a brewery.
Right.
I mean, you're putting so many of these things that we've just talked about all together
yeah.
there. The occupation right. they had, which was probably mm-hmm. typically thought of as very male-centered, mm-hmm. working at the brewery. That's a word. Do you guys have words that you have a hard time saying? Brewery is one of mine.
Yeah, that is a hard one.
So like mm-hmm. whenever I say it, like, oh, we should go tour that brewery. That's how I say it. Because it sounds like I can't say my R's.
I do want to just mention Maud, because Maud was mm-hmm. both yes. the wife and the mother. But she, like you said, Michelle, women often weren't the focus of the show. Maud was the focus of the show. She was a wife and mother. She came from the June Cleaver era. But it was her intellect and her opinions that the show focused on.
Faux show.
And that was groundbreaking.
Faux show it was.
Well, yes, it was. It wasn't just mm-hmm. necessarily the character and what they were doing. It was the topics that they were mm-hmm. able to bring to our screens, like her, the abortion conversation, the mm-hmm. women's rights talk, the things that Maud's character was able to bring to the screen.
Yeah. So she was a very well-rounded character. We knew her really well in ways that we didn't know June Cleaver.
Right.
We didn't know even Carol Brady. We didn't know her very well, except for how she took care of her children. But she was in the transitional time.
Well, and Maud, you know, Walter's not her first husband.
One of the things I thought was super interesting, I recently watched the pilot episode of Maud because our guest that you're going to hear from, Susan Silver, was a big part of that episode. And we learned so much about Maud in that probably 25 minutes. I mean, we learned this was her fourth husband. We learned about her upbringing and what her mother was like. I was amazed how great the writing was that we got a very full picture of who Maud was.
And there was a lot to know, unlike the previous women in TV. There wasn't much to know. We knew a lot. There was a lot to know about Maud.
I think the writing was really brave. And I think it was also brave of the people that put these shows on the air. And that brings me to Murphy Brown because, you know, Candace Bergen was, her character Murphy Brown, was the first single mom by choice. If you guys remember mm-hmm. that, she was very single, very career focused, and Murphy Brown becomes pregnant accidentally and she decides to keep the baby and raise him alone. And that went on the air. That whole storyline was played out. And if you remember the vice president at the time, Dan Potato Quayle, he openly criticized, that's his middle name. Did you guys know?
Right.
It's Potato. He openly criticized that. I mean, he accused the show of mocking the importance of fathers. But yet Murphy Brown, and I know Candace Bergen, I don't know
Candace Bergen?
I know. That's what I thought she said, too.
I call her Candy,
I know she's
though.
My neighbor.
Yeah, I call her Candy.
Candy Brown.
So Candy, I don't know if Candy wrote this episode, but you know Candy had a big hand in the reaction and the response to Dan Quayle's words. Because if you'll also remember that they put Dan Quayle's comments in an actual episode where Murphy Brown, during a news broadcast, she basically says, unfortunately, it seems that for him, the only acceptable definition of a family is a mother, a father, and children. And in a country where millions of children grow up in non-traditional families, that definition seems painfully unfair. So it was like reality.
Mic drop.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's all like it all merged, right? And that, talk mm-hmm. about brave. Woo.
Yeah.
And trailblazing.
Murphy Brown started in what year? Was that 1989, 88? It was the late 80s.
I can look it up while you keep talking.
Oh, I'll check for you, Kristen. It was a pretty good time. It was a pretty good time for women like Murphy Brown. If you think mm-hmm. about Claire Huxtable was portrayed as an extremely successful professional woman, in addition to being a loving mother with a beautiful home.
1988?
1988.
For 11 mm-hmm. seasons, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, Elise Keaton. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was an architect, right?
That's right. Yeah.
It's like these women were just allowed to be well-rounded characters. They weren't limited in who they could be. And help me with this, you guys. This is going backwards into the 70s again. I can't remember. Did we see Jefferson have a job before they moved on up? Did she work in the dry cleaner store?
To the east side.
To the east side. But it felt to me like when they moved on up, she was becoming a woman who didn't have a job. That's what it felt like to me. And remember, she wants to do all the work in the house, and George wants her to hire a housekeeper because they've moved on up. And she's like, no, I don't need that because I don't have anything else to do. I'll just clean the house. So it does feel like she's made a transition
mm-hmm.
into definitely. Something different. Yeah.
And I'd like to bring up one other character. We can cut this if we want to. But I'd like to bring up Abby Bradford, because I think the first moment we meet Abby, when she pulls up in her really cool 1940s MG, we immediately know that. that she is – we immediately know she's this independent woman. At least that's the feeling I got.
Professional woman.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And coming to do her job. She's tutoring Tommy since he – broke his leg and couldn't go to school. So we're introduced to her as, a professional career woman who then, of course, we know ends up marrying Tom. But at the same time, she's also this conduit between the female daughters of the Bradford family and helping stuffy Tom Bradford kind of see, like, these are independent women, your daughters. Like, they can, Yeah. I mean, you remember the pregnant friend who didn't have a place to live, and she encourages Tom to let her live with them. And just, times that all of the girls were going through something, she was this kind of wise, strong woman helping them see themselves as strong women and kind of playing
that place in
between.
That's a great one to bring up, because we talked about Abby a lot in our Eight is Enough episode, which listeners go back a little over a year. That's a really fun episode, because Abby was so non-judgmental. Like, you're right, Carolyn, there were so many storylines that were really, social issues of the time. Mm-hmm. And traditionally we had seen a different type of reaction, I would say, from like the parent. And Abby was very accepting. She was a good listener. She was also a very, her
Where
coming
Tom
in,
wasn't oftentimes.
Not often. No, he then became that. But
she would bring him around.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
She facilitated that.
Coming into that family so late, the writers could have chosen to make her kind of playing second fiddle to Tom a lot, and they didn't. She was written to be a very equal partner in that house, and a really important part of that family.
Well, and I think because she was very popular in a way that they didn't expect. We all fell in love with Abby Bradford, and I don't think they expected that. And even if you think about the girls, all the girls in that household, every single one of them, they were all on a vocational journey of some kind. Right. Nancy wanted to be an actress. Joni wanted to be a journalist. Mary wanted to be a doctor. I can't remember what Elizabeth wanted to do.
Joni wanted to be an actress, remember?
And then it was
a journalist. And then Nancy wanted to be like a model.
Yes.
Right.
With a volunteer. Yeah. Nancy wants to be like a model.
They were focused there were vocational stories for them. So they got to be well-rounded too.
Elizabeth didn't want to wear. Wasn't it Elizabeth who didn't want to wear a bra at one point?
Yes.
And Dad got all so. She might not have had a vocation, but she had ways she wanted.
She was exposing herself. That's not what I meant. She was expressing herself. Yes. Pretty and slip. My goodness.
I know.
And so you could compare all of the girls on Eight is Enough to all of the girls on Petticoat Junction. And Petticoat Junction, those girls, there was no vocational storyline. It was mostly shenanigans and, boys.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say boys and trying to get married,
trying to get married.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because when I'm thinking Eight is Enough, I'm doing the same thing. I'm thinking, how was Abby portrayed? How was Abby written? But you're right. The way those girls were written was just as impactful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we can 60s. Even go to Family. Look at Family, where, Buddy's character is, written well. And so is Meredith Baxter Burney's character is written well. Mom is a little traditional. Mm-hmm. Let's all be
Mom
honest.
Mom is pretty traditional. But Buddy gets to be, she doesn't have to be a girly girl. She gets to be who she wants to be.
Well, and Meredith Baxter Burney, she's the single mom, living in the guest house. But she's a single mom. Yeah.
Living in the guest house.
Oh, I just love that little guest house.
Oh, I love it. So cute.
I just wanted to live like
and
that.
And in the, what's her name in that? What, you guys, character name. Why is that escaping me? All right, listeners, everybody scream it right now at your device. Right. And 1, 2, 3.
Well, I'm going to actually do a little research. But so go ahead. You guys keep talking.
I was going to say Elise, but that's Elise Keaton.
You're right.
That's not right.
Nancy.
I think she was Nancy.
Yeah,
You're right. She's Nancy.
Yeah.
Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right, eating healthy, working out, but your energy still crashes or those wonky mood swings hit out of nowhere?
Oh, yes. But I've got to tell you, Michelle, that has gotten so much better since I have been taking Hormone Harmony. It really does make a difference. And I recently took their free 2-minute quiz. I learned that menopause can have my hormones all out of whack. Hormone Harmony helps to fine-tune my hormonal system, and it helps maintain optimal hormone levels. It's helped with my menopause-related brain fog, my quality of sleep, and really overall well-being. I just feel better. And I also feel good knowing they only use proven science-backed ingredients in all of their herbal formulas. And what's great about the quiz is that it will recommend the best product for you based on your answers and your particular hormonal needs.
Yeah, I love that they actually have a whole line for your gut health, like Bloat Banisher. Is that TMI? I don't know. If you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with our code PCPS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code PCPS for 15% off today.
Hey, listeners, it's Carolyn, and I wanted to share with you my latest armoire success story. Okay, picture this. Cobblestone streets, gelato in hand, and a suitcase that doesn't weigh a ton. That was actually my reality on a recent trip I took to Italy. Seriously, you guys, my trip to Italy was a style triumph. From the most comfortable jeans I have ever worn, so comfortable, you guys, that I've decided I'm going to purchase these, the perfect lightweight sweater, and then there was my absolute favorite fun checkered rain jacket that actually received compliments. Armoire is like having a dream closet at your fingertips. You tell them your style, and they send you amazing pieces that you can rent. Or you can just scroll through their amazing collection of high-quality items and choose what works for you. No more agonizing over what to pack, no more overstuffed suitcases, just effortless style delivered right to your door. Wear it, love it, send it back, and get a fresh batch. So you guys, you can ditch the packing stress and really elevate your vacation wardrobe. And right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/PCPS. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/PCPS to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
There were so many stories in the stories by my grandma. There were so many TV shows in the 60s that were about men. It was Gomer Pyle and Hogan's Heroes and F Troop. Right.
So
and
true.
When I'm trying to think about the women and how they were portrayed prior to Marlo Thomas and Mary Tyler Moore, I actually had trouble coming up with more than a handful because it was sort of male dominated stories. And so that's why we just have June Cleaver and Lucy and Laura Petry over and over again. Hazel, but she was a housekeeper.
And Ozzie yeah, a little Harriet. Ditzy.
Of course, we're celebrating all of these strong, you know, empowered women, but there were still going to always be ditzy women characters of in course. All of these shows. And yeah. We love them too for different reasons. Yeah. But, you know, I came, you know, Chrissy Snow and Georgette on the Mary Tyler Moore show. You had to have some balance, right?
I mean, but even Edith. Chrissy and Janet were, they were single women. They were not focused on getting married and having children. They were out
well,
doing
that was
their
true.
Thing.
She yeah. was still a little ditzy, but still.
As ditzy as she was still not a wife or mother.
We've got our own. I mean, I can.
And then you said Edith. Yeah, Edith Bunker. That's an
interesting
one.
Well, I'm only saying Edith Bunker because she was a little bit submissive. I almost said submersive. She was underwater the whole time. She was probably a little submissive. Yeah.
That was part of the story because Meathead and Gloria. were trying to pull her out of the 1950s. Like, Mom, mm-hmm. you don't have to do what Daddy says. Right. That was right. part of the storyline. So Edith's role had to be that way in order to be a contrast to Gloria.
Right.
Right. Well, one other thing I thought was interesting, I decided I was going to look up who was the first kind of lead female doctor in like a medical series or hospital series. Consistently, it came up Dr. Quinn, medicine woman.
Oh.
Like, you know, we had Marcus Welby. We had Medical Center with Chad Everett. We had some right. other shows, Emergency. But those were all male dominated. I was even thinking of St. Elsewhere, and I couldn't think of a female. I mean, the females were like the nurses. It probably mm-hmm. wasn't until ER that we maybe finally got some female doctors that at least I can remember. So I thought that was really interesting. Although Andy pointed out there weren't a whole lot of female doctors anyway, just in the profession.
But that doesn't mean there were zero.
Well, exactly. Right. And wouldn't that have been a good storyline? So it was sad that Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, was
is the first. That is kind of shocking. Because you had Dixie on Emergency. Everyone loves Dixie. She was the nurse.
She was
and let's
nurse.
Not forget Julia. Julia, who was a nurse. Right. And she was also a single mom, wasn't she?
Right.
The first Black woman to carry a TV show. She was mm-hmm. the star of a TV show. And she, Diane Carroll admitted before she died, she was like, it wasn't perfect. I was being written by white men. And that was super frustrating. But she wasn't going to turn down the opportunity to be the first Black woman to carry a TV show.
Right.
Okay. So there's a great book called Hot Pants in Hollywood, Sex, Secrets, and Sitcoms by Susan Silver. Susan was one of those legendary writers for the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And in her book, Susan talks about her life in this world of TV men and ultimately her role in giving authentic life to these now iconic female characters. Mm-hmm. And it was our extreme pleasure to talk with Susan Silver, the Susan Silver. She is feminist TV royalty, even though I know that would totally make her roll her eyes, but still.
Susan has had such an interesting life and she's so inspirational. Just all the doors she, busted down and the lessons she learned. Also, another thing about this book, it's a very kiss and tell book. There's a lot mm-hmm. of names dropped, which as a fangirl, I loved reading. Actually, I listened to the book, which, if you are someone who enjoys Audibles, I highly recommend it. Susan reads it and it's like she's telling you this over coffee. It's like she's telling you her life story over coffee. It's very conversational and fun. Please enjoy this fun and lively conversation with the legendary, trailblazing, and very unfiltered Susan Silver.
I would like to formally welcome you to the Pop Culture Preservation Society. You are looking at the first generation of children to be influenced by the Mary Tyler Moore Show, right? And it is because of you and your trailblazing efforts and the efforts of the other women who were just banging down the doors of the writers' rooms, the TV writers' rooms in the 1970s, that we Gen X women, we were children at the time, we Gen X women got to grow up with female characters who were funny and nuanced and multidimensional and
real.
Authentic.
Yes,
real female TV characters, people who became our heroes, not just people to set up the joke.
Right.
So we are very happy to have you here today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be had. I've been in the house for 2 years now with the pandemic, and I'm really bored.
This is a good way to get out.
Oh, my God. And I don't I have a garden, which I go out to, but now they're doing drilling in the back of a townhouse, so I can't even sit in my garden. So I'm quite insane by now.
I bet. Well, we're happy to be your entertainment for the day.
No kidding.
Mary Tyler Moore was really the first attempt to portray a woman who was not a wife or a mother. She was something different.
That girl.
Yes. Of course. Okay, so we'll say one of.
I have to give credit to Marlo and I'll tell you my story about that. I had a writing partner, Iris Rayner Dart, who wrote Beaches, who's still my dear friend. And we were trained together under Gary Marshall, who was our mentor. And we had an appointment with the Batgirl group. And of course, they were all men. And it wasn't a very good meeting, but we pitched our story about them getting, Donald and she getting engaged and married. And it was the engagement party, and they bought the script. And then Marlo said, no, she loved the script, but she didn't want to get married. She didn't want to make girls think that you had to get married. So they never did. But she really paved the way in a lot of ways.
That's a really, really good point, because I was watching that girl at 3 years old.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you can't tell me that that's not seeping into my skin. Right?
Those Where were your parents?
My parents turned on the TV for me.
They're you like, occupied.
It was the babysitter.
Well, we did have a great podcast episode all about Free to Be You and Me, where we actually did kind of extol Marlo's just great trailblazing, you know, efforts in that as well. And also just teaching us so much as children, even just through that album.
She had her own production company too, because of her dad and everything. So, I mean, she really was a trailblazer. So I give her the credit, even though Mary was the first time that they hired women.
Well, and that is really what I would like to know about. So we'll say Mary Tyler Moore was like one of the first times that a woman was portrayed, not just as a wife or a mother. And it was also one of the first shows to purposefully pursue women to write the show. And you are one of those people that they pursued. Can you tell us about the campaign that they had to recruit women's voices, and how did you get involved with the show?
I was the casting director of Rowan and Martin's Laugh, and which is before your time, but you know, you're Bippy and things like that. And I wanted to write, and they said, you can't write because the guys are all in an apartment in their underwear and they want to fart and they can't fart if you're there. And I said, no, they can fart if I'm there. But they didn't want to. So I was very upset. And I had gone out with some guy and I'd run into him, and now I was dating somebody else. And he said, oh, you should meet my new girlfriend. She wants to write. And she's being managed by Gary Marshall, the producer of Happy Days and Odd Couple and all those other things. And he has his own little company that he had set up for his father. He was great with nepotism. Penny was his sister, his other sister, his father. And he manages writers. And so Iris Rayner Dart, who wrote Beaches, and I, she was under 5 feet tall. And my husband said he never knew I had a partner because he'd never looked under 5 feet. So I was writing by myself and talking to myself. Anyway, she and I are still great friends. So we went on our, we got a Love American Style that we sold. And then we got this Batgirl, which we wrote but didn't sell. And then she took a break to have a baby. And I saw this show called Mary Tyler Moore. And I said, Gary, I can do this show. She's from Minneapolis. I'm from Milwaukee. She, you know, wants to be a career girl. I worked at a small television station in Los Angeles as one of my jobs. So he said, okay, I'll get you an appointment. And only because he referred me did they take me. He said, I'll back you up. And when I went in there, Treva Silverman was there. She was the first woman, and she did a lot of the show. She was a friend of Jim and Alan's, and I was the second woman. And from then on, they hired 25 women. So they really made an effort, and they changed. And that's why the show was so good, because it was the first time. Just little things, and I talk about it in my book.
Yes. yes.
Where I said, at one point they said, and then Mary goes and gets cleaned up. And I said, no, we don't go and get cleaned up. We take a bath or a shower. It's different. They said, oh, okay. You know, little things like that that made it more real and more natural. And all the shows I did were for my own life. My first one was how she comes in one day and Twinks is there.
Twinks, oh, we love Twinks.
Who was the receptionist, who was your friend in camp. You know, you always get some person that knew you from 100 years ago and thinks you're their best friend. And then you have to stand up to their wedding and wear an ugly dress. Every woman knows that. Any woman could have pitched that story. They thought I was a genius. Where would you get this idea? You know. And I also took that my husband and I were looking for a house, and the real estate guy's name was Arnold Tvedt. And he gave me his card. I said, you can't kill this name with a stick. If you take out the E, it's still Tvedt. If you take out the D, it's still Tvedt. It's Tvedt. So that was perfect. So I just pitched stuff from my own life. And then another show was when Valerie lost her job, Rhoda lost her job.
I love this one.
And there was a job opening at the station, and Mary didn't want her to have it for like 1 minute, she said. And Ed said, wow, you're just as lousy as all the rest of us. I said, no, even though you love your friends and you want to be with them, sometimes you want your own little special nest and you don't know how it's going to work out. And of course, Mary immediately said, no, she'd offer her the job. You know, and then she said, I don't want it. I have a better job.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I did all the things from my own life. And all the writers afterward, the 25 women, I think, changed TV.
For us, it was the friendship between Rhoda and Mary that was written so real that we knew that men really couldn't be writing.
Well, why should you pay? No matter what it is. Because I want to. And because I lied when I said it was Phil.
What?
Rhoda, I don't know why I did it. I guess maybe I thought I would have to be responsible for you, or that, you know, maybe it wouldn't be good for our friendship to be working that closely together all the time. You know, we'd get on each other's nerves, maybe, but anyway, I'm sorry I did it, and it's yours if you still want it.
What's mine if I still want it?
The job!
Yeah, it was a unique experience, and it was an incredible experience. And also, I didn't know that you could make anything up. That's how ill-informed I was. I thought I had to only tell the truth. Wow. So I had to tell stories from my own life. And if I said, I've said this before, if I had a meeting on a Wednesday and nothing had happened to me on Tuesday, I would like panic. I'd go through the phone book, airport, car, call, what? I thought it had to be my own life. So I only pitched stories from my own life. Partridge Family, I did the hot pants story for Shirley Jones because I wore hot pants. Maude,
can you describe that episode for us again? Shirley is she going to school? Is that right?
No, Shirley Jones. Well, I did two different ones. Shirley Jones meets a young guy who has a crush on her, and his parents come to challenge her, and she's wearing hot pants because they decide to do that for the band. Because I wore hot pants, and TV Guide wrote an article, which I have up there, said, you know, they don't give you $3,500. That's what we used to get because you have good legs. And that's sort of, from then on, I became the person in hot pants. I actually wore hot pants. I am so sorry, feminists. I don't know why I did, but it worked. What can I say?
Hey, if you have good legs, there's no shame in flaunting them.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was the beginning. And I also, Maude, I wrote, the first Maude was the daughter, Carol, was going to therapy, and the mother and Maude said, "You're going to blame everything on me." Yes, that's what I said to my mother. I'm going to therapy. She said, "Are you going to blame me everything?" And my mother was kind of Maude-like. I was terrified of her, and I said, "Of course I am going to blame everything on you." And so, most of those shows. Oh, and then my other Mary, I did where she's interviewing the guy, and the tape recorder breaks, and they go out.
Oh, I love this show. Is it Paul Sand? Is that who that is?
What happened was I saw a review. There was a guy in Chicago who said Mary's undersexed. So I went in the next time and I said, "Guys, they said Mary's undersexed. Let's get her some sex." You know, that was that one. And then another one. I had a crush on a teacher, and this was the Michael Tolan one where she goes to take a class and she gets a B minus. And what do I have to do to get a B? You know, she starts dating him. So all the stories were from my own life.
How exciting was it when you would write a line? Let's just say, for example, for Twinks. So when you're writing and you create this character, I mean, you're writing for Twinks, and then Pat Finley walks in and delivers them, and not just delivers them, but just, I mean, she just slays that character and the lines. But you sometimes forget that, wait, somebody put those words in her mouth.
Everybody forgets. They think the actors are making them up on us.
But how thrilling was that for you to go to the table read and just see those words come to life so brilliantly?
Yeah, the other thing is, back in the day, this was the best place to work. No other place invited you to the table read. You know, they take your script, they'd rewrite it and change it and everything. I mean, these guys, I was involved in every step along the way, plus the tapings, and it was wonderful. And yeah, Pat was very funny. She was good.
Hi, kid. I got the brochures from the travel agency. Now, they have this trip to Hawaii that looks
like...
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you had company.
No. Oh, I'm not company. I'm Twinks.
Twinks?
Rhoda Morgenstern, Twinks McFarlane.
Twinks. We know each other from Amwak.
Amwak.
You know, Camp Amwak.
I say I'm between 50 and death. I don't really lie.
I love that line. But I loved that line.
And I did this on my book tour. I had one bad experience, unfortunately, with a woman, believe it or not. They said, "This is a feminist woman and she's dying to interview." And I said, "Great." And she said something about how old you are. And I said, "I say I'm between 50 and death." And she got so upset. "That's anti-feminist." I said, "Excuse me. I was a feminist before you were born, number one. And number two, it's all about choice.
I love that, how you said that.
We can have plastic surgery if we want to. Yes, we do. We can be white-haired or blonde. I've been blonde for many years. I'm now white-haired because I've been in the house for 2 years. And it saves me a lot of money. And, you know, I still want to have a date and get married again. So I'm between 50 and death. Yep. But anyway, yeah, the thing is that feminism, at the time, Iris and I actually went to a meeting and they were literally talking about burning their bras. And I said, I was the last person in grade school to get a bra. I was flat chested. I was the only one wearing an undershirt and I'm not giving up this bra.
I will my bra.
Pay my dues in work. I will break the ceiling in any way, but I am not getting rid of this.
Got rid of my bra during the pandemic. I'm having a lot of trouble going back.
Yeah, I agree.
I go out now and it's very common to see
people without
always
their,
in a yeah,
I'm in my nightgown and I don't have a bra on, but I'm
glad to know that I'm in my pajama pants right now.
Me
can
too.
I just can I just share one
I
more
don't
just
because this is on. Go on. It's
there's the cold open. Okay, I get so thrilled now, you know, knowing we were going to be talking with you and going back and rewatching. I mean, I'm not just pandering to you, I promise, Susan.
Oh,
but like,
pander, go on.
Some of your episodes of Mary Tyler Moore, because we've all watched all of the Mary Tyler Moore episodes probably multiple times. I was so thrilled to learn which ones you wrote and to see your name come up by Susan Silver. I'm like, I know her.
Yes.
I didn't know you yet, but I was sort of like, I know her. Anyway, I just wanted to just tell you that those are some of my, before I even knew you wrote them, those are some of my favorite episodes. And can I tell you, after, you know, just in the past week, I've been going back and rewatching some of them again. And I just want to share this line that has always cracked me up from The Square-Shaped Room, which is the episode you wrote in which Ed Asner won an Emmy. We love a good Phyllis zinger here because Phyllis is awesome. Mary is talking to Phyllis and she's saying, you know, I think I'm going to ask Rhoda to step in and decorate. And Phyllis is like, well, she can't do that. She's, you know, not an interior decorator. And Mary says this, and this is coming straight from Susan Silver's mind, you guys. Haven't you seen the Christmas windows she's done at Hempel's? Phyllis says, then Rhoda's your girl if Mr. Grant wants to live in a manger.
Oh, it cracks
me up. And I just wanted to let you know that you've given us so many laughs.
The best one from that show is why Ed won his Emmy, which I loved Ed so much. He was the best when he walks in and he sees this room and it's all white and modern. And he says, I love it. I love it. And she says, yes, look at the bedroom. He leaves and he turns to Mary. He says, I hate it.
It's so good.
I hate it.
It's so good.
Oh, it's so awesome.
He was awesome. And he almost does it in the same breath.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The same
face is still in the same frozen smile. He's like, I love it.
And when he points to the print and he says, because it has that five and he said, she must have gone through four other ones before she decided on this.
That was
one.
A good one. Yeah.
I love that. It's so classic. And we're still talking about it.
Like, oh, I know.
When you're talking about that episode in your book, I know. I can see it in my head. I'm playing it in my head.
You guys are super fans. You're super Mary fans.
But it's kind of universal. I don't think I'm the only one who's able to do that. And that is a testament to the quality of the TV.
Well, the biggest laugh I ever got out of all my shows, see if you know what it is. What do you think?
Oh,
I'm guessing the bridesmaid dress.
Well, that was
the bridesmaid's dress.
That was
yes.
Mary,
did you? Can I ask you a question?
Purple.
Did you write that in the script? Like, did you describe what you wanted that dress to look like? Little Bo Peep.
All that's
basically.
Missing is the sheep. It would look like Bo Peep.
Yes.
You did a brilliant job. And then I said, the only thing uglier than this dress is this
dress in purple.
No, the biggest laugh was in the show where Rhoda is hanging around Mary's apartment all the time because she doesn't have a job and she has her hair dry around.
Oh, I love that.
And Phyllis jumped.
Yes.
Oh. I'm trying not to make too much noise.
Well, those hair dryers. Remember we used to wear them?
Yes. And Phyllis just takes the hose out of Rhoda's hair dryer and talks into it. Yeah. Rhoda.
So all the characters on that show were so individual and just so wildly just different, but just characters, right? So how much fun was that to write for all the zingers, like Ted's zingers, or, you know, Murray's comebacks, or
Phyllis.
The band, like, just like the, yeah, Phyllis and Rhoda, like, did you just have a ball, like, once you got an idea who these characters were, then was it just kind of off to the races, writing for their specific voices?
Well, that's when I used to teach, I would say, to be a sitcom writer is really to be a good listener. Just to know that Mary sounds different than Rhoda and Ed sounds different than, I mean, that's all. So what you should do is watch a show a million times so you hear the voices and know that they're all different. And then you just plug it in. It's just being a copycat. It really is. And I mean, to me, it was very easy. And I know it's not. So that's probably why I did okay, because it was just, I was able to hear the difference in the voices and know who would say that or who would, you know, say something else. And like my favorite line ever was when Ted was so much fun to write for, except he got upset because he thought people really thought he was stupid and he wasn't. But anyway, he's reading something in the news and it says World War I.
Oh, I love that.
World War I. That was my favorite line I ever wrote, ever. World War I. And Mary's like dying, you know.
Well, and it's so perfect for Ted. I also just always love between him and Murray, like how Murray just goads him all the time. So
they were they were such great people. But you see, the genius of that show was the creation of those characters. I felt it was Mary in the center and it was a spoke with a wheel and they were all around. They don't necessarily see that way, but I did. But each character was so brilliantly conceived and written that you could go on forever and you knew, I mean, that's the other thing. You know what everybody's attitude is. So when something happens, you know how they're going to react and if you pay attention. And the thing is that I knew so little. You're never supposed to come in with a guest star being the focus of your show. It's always supposed to be the cast. But when I came in with Twinks, they liked the idea of the story. And it was like, that was a rule that was broken. You never really add another character to be the focus of a show on your first show because they want to see how well you write the people in the show.
One of the brilliant aspects of the Mary Tyler Moore Show is that they handed us characters that maybe we weren't supposed to like, and yet we did. And one of those is Phyllis. I adore Phyllis.
Oh,
I
yes.
adore that woman.
She's crazy, Cloris.
Oh, well, and that's what I wonder, because I hear the things about Cloris Leachman about, you talked about the spokes on the wheel. Where does Cloris Leachman fit on that?
Way up there.
She was up into the ceiling.
Even in the readings, it was so interesting. You'd go to the readings. Mary would read it exactly right, exactly the way she was going to do it in the show. Valerie would try different things. She wasn't sure. And Phyllis wasn't even in the room. She'd come late. She wouldn't stay in her place. She didn't know. She hadn't read it. She said, and the camera guys would go nuts because they never knew what she was going to. She was a genius, though.
Well, that almost, the way you just described them, it almost sounds like they're characters, though. Like, that's what Mary would do. That's what Rhoda would do. That's what Phyllis would do.
That's so true. And then she delivered, like, it sounds like her insanity is what she brought to the performance, and people loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. But then it's so interesting when they did the spinoff, it didn't work.
Oh, I was all there for it. Maybe I was the only one watching. I was the only one.
No, I mean, I have somewhere up here the top 10 shows, you know, from the Writers Guild, and over the years it was one because those guys, Jim Brooks and Alan Burns, just designed the most perfect, wonderful experience. And also to work for them was so wonderful. They treated you so well and you were included, and it was heaven. And then I went on to other places and it was not heaven.
You mentioned Maude earlier, and how involved were you in the creation of her character? Because you were involved in the very first episode. Did they hand you a character and say, Maude is like this, can you write for this? Or did you say, I want Maude to be like this?
No, what happened was, and this is really was a unique experience, but Norman Lear was the other genius. There were three great geniuses at the time, the MTM guys, Gary, who he always said he wanted to do Recess in the day, and Norman, who did the serious political incredible stuff, and he's 100 years old this year. And
he's so amazing. So great. Yeah.
So Maude was a spinoff of All in the Family. Maude was the cousin, and she came on for one episode there. So they already knew who she was. And then he got a buy for the show to be Maude, but he was on vacation. So they asked me to come in and write the first one. Rod Parker was the producer. And I wrote it. I came in with my story of my mother and me and everything. I wrote it. And they did, I would say, a pretty good, like maybe half rewriting. Now it's very upset. But Norman came back and he knew that character. It was his wife. He knew what he wanted it to be. And nobody else had seen it or done it. So I said, you know what? I understand. And then he was so kind. He kept my name on it, which he didn't need to. I mean, it was my story and it was my premise and everything, but he didn't really need to. But anywhere else, if they rewrote me, I just never went back. But that was unique in that show because he knew that character so well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go to taping because I was afraid of Bea Arthur. So.
Oh, yeah. She
literally
that
afraid of her.
Well.
Is that because of who she was or because she was like your mom?
Both, I think. I didn't want her to say, who wrote this shitty script? I'm not going to do it.
It sounds like these were really incredible men and they were enlightened men to work for. That's not what I expect to hear about these stories.
Anyway, but these guys were so great. And then you go to other places and you expect it to be the same way. And it wasn't. Wow. And some of the guys were really nasty. And there's a producer who Iris and I called Feet. I won't say who he was. We came into the meeting and he put his feet up on the desk right in our faces. And another guy who I did talk about, I think he's dead now. But anyway, we went into the office and he had an entire wall of breasts, pictures of breasts.
Oh, yes, I remember.
Now, are you the secretaries? We said, no, we're the writers. And what are those?
Well, can I just say then, thank you for sticking with it. Because there are probably a lot of women that would have said, fuck this. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I have to tell you the truth. My book, aside from the showbiz and the boomer stuff and everything, is about three things. It's about reinvention, which you have to do mm-hmm. for 20 years. And as we get older, you know that. You guys did it. Resilience, which I never knew I had until I wrote the book. And relationships. Resilience, I was so surprised that I went through these things. But if I had started out on a show that was mean to me, I probably would have given up. Mm-hmm. People magazine did an article about the women writers, and they had different names for them. And mine said pushy, pushy, pushy. And I cried for 2 days. And my husband said, you get a t-shirt and you write pushy, pushy, pushy. And you wear it to all your meetings. And I did. And he was right. But I cried for 2 days. So I wouldn't have had the resilience had I started out in a show that was mean to me.
Right. Wow. And that's a kismet of sorts, because that show clearly needed to be. It needed to be. We needed to have it 50 years later.
I think for our generation, particularly this Gen X generation who grew up watching that part of Saturday night TV, and as women or girls then, and we've heard this from our listeners, Mary was like the role model. I mean, when we looked for our first apartments, we had Mary's apartment in our mind. We were mm-hmm. looking for the wall that we were going to hang our initial on.
I have one.
Yes, we wanted to be Mary. So in a way, you directly impacted how we walked through life and, you know, the women that we held up as role models and who we wanted to be when we were going to be, you know, out of college. We didn't have to get married. We could get a job.
And I was the only one of my girls growing up. There were four Susans and a Judy. Everybody was named Susan in my era. And they all went to Wisconsin to get their MRS. Mm-hmm. And I was the only one who went somewhere else to get a career.
Yeah.
So I, now that I am this incredibly giving human, you can all ask to find a guy for me. I have got to get married again within the next year or it'll be too late. And I had column called The Search for Mr. Adequate. I haven't found him yet. And I've been divorced from another generation and another century. So it's time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Susan, you got to get out of your house, though, to make that happen.
That would help.
Yeah.
That would help. I kept saying, why can't someone move next door? Two single guys did move next door, but they had girlfriends. And I just want that next door to be the option. I just want them to knock on the door.
Drink and turn the world on with a smile.
This was an amazing conversation. I'm so happy to meet you.
Thank you.
I am, too. And I feel like the next time I see Written by Susan Silver and I say, I know her. She's my, can I call you my friend? I feel like I'm friendly with you.
If I'm your husband, you can call me your best friend.
Yay.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Listeners, okay. We'll have to put that out to our people.
Yes. This is what I want.
Yes.
Okay. 65 to 75, tall, really good looking. I'm so superficial. Really, really, really smart. My husband was like, so smart. You have to be really smart and fun and likes to travel and not working anymore because you want to have fun.
Okay. Listeners, we've put it out there.
That's right.
It's out in the universe. Right, DM us your suggestions. Mm-hmm. Susan That's is right. drop dead gorgeous. She is so smart. She has the best energy and stories and let's set her up. Let's do
can
it.
I
let's
show
do
you this. One thing.
Yeah. And then wait, can we ask you though if we can come to your wedding?
Oh, please.
Okay, great. Thank you. If we make this happen.
Oh, look.
Oh yeah. Could you just take us around your office?
Sure.
You guys, I'm going to tell you what we're seeing. We are seeing beautiful photos, framed in her office.
You're going to make it after all.
And then these are pictures of Susan.
Oh, there's Sean, her crush. Yeah. Wasn't that Sean
celebrity crush?
Yes. Yeah, I think it was.
You guys just books and pictures and articles framed. Right. Oh my gosh. It's such a pleasure to know you now. And I hope we can continue our relationship.
To Minneapolis, but I'm going to California in September to a conference, and then I'm going to Florida to try it out.
Hey, well, you might meet someone there, Susan.
That's why I'm going mainly.
Yeah. I love you.
Well, we guarantee you a year from now, we will be meeting your significant other.
From your lips to God's ears, because I really need sex.
She needs to find a man now.
Yes. Okay.
I love you guys.
We love you too.
Can we like do this just to hang out sometimes?
Oh my gosh. Yes. It's so fun. Oh my goodness. That was fun. Many, many thanks to the lovely Susan Silver. She's not kidding about that boyfriend, by the way. If your dad is single and meets Susan's requirements, please send us a DM right away. I mean, think about it. You could be just one degree away from Mary Richards. That's a big deal. So thanks to Susan, not just for her time today, but also for the legend she helped create, who in turn expanded the dreams of an entire generation of little girls. We were those little girls who had a future that didn't look like, you know, the people from the 50s. Because of her and the army of women who wrote for Mary Tyler Moore, we always knew that we would make it on our own. Thanks for listening today.
Yes, and please join us next week for another fun-filled, nostalgic trip down memory lane. And we'd love for you also to get to read Susan's book. So I'm including in the show notes a link to her book as well as in this week's weekly reader. If you don't already subscribe to our newsletter, you can visit our website or check out our link in bio on Instagram.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening. And thank you all for sharing our podcast with others. We see your DMs, we read your emails, and a lot of you tell us that you're sharing our podcast with all the people you know. And we appreciate that so much. Honestly, it helps. And for rating and for leaving a nice review on Apple Podcasts, we read all of those as well. And if you don't, you should go to Apple Podcasts and read all the nice reviews. They're really sweet. They make us feel good, right? They're a nice boost. It tells us that these conversations that we have mean something to you guys. And that in turn means a lot to us. And we appreciate so much all of our patrons over on Patreon for really keeping this podcast trucking. Did I say that right? Right. I think I did. This week we are giving a special shout out to patrons Jeremy, Amy, Francis, Taylor, and Rachel. Thank you all so much for your support.
In the meantime, let's
the information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. Cheers. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on trucking, and may the force be with you. Spread